This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
I'd like to thank the Islamic Society of Bath for inviting me today to talk about how the West can understand Islam. And I requested that topic very specifically because usually I give different discussions on Sharia, and I give discussions on Islam and Christianity and Islam from a more theological perspective. But one of the things I've always kind of tried to mention is how the West understands Islam, or how to translate Islam into something that people from a Western background can actually understand and not misrepresent because of translation problems. And the reason being is explaining concepts are more than just translating literal words from one language to another. I think many of you here are bilingual, I'm assuming. Anyone here only speak one language? No shame. Only one language? Just English?
Yeah.
Just English? Yeah. Only one language. Okay, no shame, but you should always try to learn other languages because it's a great mind expander, especially when you see how different languages approach different concepts. And sometimes I love to find words in other languages which are not fully translatable in English. For example, like in Portuguese, which is kind of my family, the language of my family, we have a word called soldado, which can't really be translated into English. Some people might say it's a longing or it's a nostalgia, but you can't find the right a proper English word that translates that Portuguese word soldado, for example. And there are many other words in Arabic and Urdu, and I'm sure many of you here can think of some words which are very hard to translate. And one of the reasons being is because translation is more than just literal translation, but you're trying to translate a meaning and what a concept means in another society. So, for example, the word justice as a word, even in English, it's very hard to translate that into other languages because different languages or cultures have different understandings about what the word justice means. And I've often found, especially when I was reading English translations of the sayings of the Prophet Muhammad or Quranic terms, many of these translations come from the Victorian era, and many of the English words used are not really descriptive of the actual Arabic words used, and it leads to a lot of confusion. And unfortunately, because the Quran, for example, some of these old translations are translated from a Victorian mindset, it infuses into the Quran concepts which either might be more Christian in understanding or might be Western Christian in understanding, and misrepresents actually what the Quran is trying to say, leading to people who reading the Quran, some of these old translations, and being quite shocked and thinking, whoa, why is it saying this? Well, this is quite a shocking word to use here and there, so what's going on? And I've spent a lot of my time showing from the Arabic language as well as from how the Islamic civilization understood these terms, how the translations are not the most accurate. And there are a few examples I like to bring to mind. One example is the term apostasy. So the word in Arabic that's usually translated into the English as apostasy is irtidad in Arabic. And a person who is committed irtidad is called a murtad. So this is translated in English as an apostate, or someone has committed apostasy. And the thing is that to a Western audience, the wording apostasy, okay, thank you, lot of Red Bulls. unfortunately, I didn't get much sleep last night, so they've heeded my plight. anyway, so the word apostasy in the English language, and certainly in modern, let's say, 20th century, 21st century European mindsets, is a concept of someone that merely just changes their religion or changes their mind, as in they just they've left one religion or they have left a community. Well, that was actually the leaving a community. Actually, was the traditional medieval understanding of it. But now we have the we just view apostate as someone who just leaves or changes their mind or has a different belief about something. Whereas the word in Arabic irtidad, it literally translates as to renege or to become a renegade. So murtad literally translates as turning renegade. And when you see how it's applied in the Islamic judicial sources, if you were to make a more accurate translation into the English as to what it refers to, it's more sedition, causing sedition or treason. And in English law, for example, sedition and treason can be defined by people not necessarily becoming violent or even advocating violence, but people who are trying to, by their words, undermine the state and overturn the Her Majesty the Queen and so on and so forth. That will be classified as sedition and treason. And when people say, oh, but are you saying that? And then one of the other problems is that people then believe that Islam is considered sedition and treason to be anyone who questions Islam, which again is not the case. But when Europeans look into their own history, they say, oh, look at the Soviet Union, look at certain fascist governments. Questioning the state ideology was viewed as sedition and treason. And so they think that must be then what Islam is referring to here. Again, projection from their own history into a completely different civilization that has a different understanding. Well, just to kind of allay that quite abruptly, no, that's not the case. Because in Islam, in Islamic civilization, medieval precedent, in the medieval Islamic Iraq, Baghdad, in Al-Andalus, which is Iberia, under Islamic times, you had public debates between Christians, atheists, Zoroastrians, Hindus, and Muslims, openly questioning, criticizing Islam. St. John of Damascus is a Catholic saint. Why is he called St. John of Damascus? It's because he lived in Islamic Syria. And he published the first Christian polemic against Islam. He published it in Syria, in the Levant. He didn't go anywhere else to do it. And nothing happened to him. He wasn't executed or killed or what have you, because Islam doesn't believe that, firstly, anyone should be forced to change their religion. But secondly, those who have a different religion or different belief about Islam, because they believe it, they have a different belief about Islam, they have the right to express that different belief and to express their concerns about Islam. How is truth and falsehood ever going to be known if no one is able to openly debate these things? And the Prophet Muhammad himself had one of the first, well, obviously the first Muslim-Christian debate in the Prophet's own mosque in Medina. The Christian delegation of Najran, it was a Christian Arab city, came to the Prophet Muhammad, came to Medina, the city of the Prophet Muhammad, city where you had the first Islamic polity, and had a debate in the Prophet's own mosque for 3 days and two nights. Obviously, they slept between, not, it wasn't a continuous debate for 3 days and nights, but for 3 days, they had a continuous debate. And at the end of it, they rejected the Prophet Muhammad's, invitation to Islam. They didn't believe he was a prophet, which in a way implies that he's lying, or you're saying he's a liar. If someone says he's a prophet, you're saying, no, I don't believe that, you're implying they're lying. And what did the Prophet Muhammad do? Well, because it was a long journey back from Medina to Najran, and he offered if they wanted to do their Christian prayers in the mosque before going back to their city. And that, as Muslims, we use them as a model. So not only is debate tolerated, it is actually accepted and encouraged, and the response to people who criticize Islam is actually hospitality and not censor. But what I've found, certainly with, and again, this is not it's very hard to obviously try to avoid generalizations, and you can't generalize the Western mindset towards Islam. But there are, let's say, segments within Western society. Sometimes we call them Islamophobes or the far right or xenophobes or neoconservatives or what have you, which view Islam or the Islamic civilization as in a way that they self-project the worst of European history onto the Islamic civilization, thinking that this must be the same as what we experienced in the West to a various degrees. And that simply isn't the case. And this is why I really wanted to do a lecture on how the West could understand Islam. But I wanted to actually ask a more fundamental question first, because I think it's an interesting preliminary. And it's something that both Muslims and others, and people who call themselves Westerners, and technically, obviously, I'm a Westerner as well. A more basic question is basically, what is the West? What is Western civilization? How do you actually define it? And it's actually quite a fascinating concept, because Western civilization, if you understand what the civilization is, you can then understand where the mentalities, the thoughts, the thinking, and better yet, how you can translate concepts from a different civilization into a way that could be understood from their own reference points. So, what is the West? Generally, we intuitively know what is a Western country, and what is a Westernized country, and what is a non-Western country. So, a Western country, we'd say, okay, England, Western country, Spain, Western country, United States, what do you think?
Western
country. Australia.
Western.
Yeah, it's not in Europe, is it? But Western country. What about Malaysia?
Well,
Western. Huh?
Westernized.
Westernized, but not a Western country. What about Japan?
Westernized.
Yes, but not a Western country. Yeah, Westernized, but not Western. Even though it has a secular liberal political system, although the culture is very different from the individualized kind of culture we have in Western Europe, but the political system is what we call secular liberal. So even though there are countries on other continents, we intuitively know what is Western and what is Westernized and what is completely non-Western. So Russia, is it Western?
Yeah.
No one would consider Russia Western. I'm actually going to actually test you. What about Poland? It's a tricky one. Western?
Westernized.
Okay, let's take Westernized out of the word, because that might be confused. Just Western or not Western? Let's just make it more simpler. So Poland, Western or non-Western?
It's former Soviet Union, so it's hard to say.
Okay, good. What do you think?
Non-Western.
Non-Western? It's Western. It actually is Western. Yeah, it was part of the Soviet Union, but it came back into the fold of the West. What about Greece?
Western.
Think Western? Well, actually, technically, not Western. And there's a reason for this. Even though Western philosophy includes ancient Greek philosophy in it, it's not Western, and there's a very simple reason for this. So, it all relates to the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire was not a European empire. It was a Mediterranean empire, right? North Africa was just as much part of the Roman Republic and then later on the Roman Empire as Spain and Italy. In fact, Germania and what was beyond the far region, initially England, then north of England, was considered to be a bunch of barbarians, uncivilized barbarians, unsophisticated, backward. Scandinavians and all these individuals, again, were considered to be barbarians and unsophisticated Northmen, the Northmen, as they were called. So they weren't considered to be part of the Roman Empire. Germania, or Germany as we now call it, was never under the Roman Empire. There was the border was pretty much well, the Roman Empire. There was many fights and skirmishes, but it was never actually conquered. But what most people don't realize is that the Roman Empire, towards the end of its time, it's split into two sides. Western Roman Empire, Eastern Roman Empire. And it split along language. The Western Roman Empire was Latin speaking. The Eastern Roman Empire was Greek speaking. Now, technically, people say that the Roman Empire fell in the 5th century. It's not actually true, because the capital of the Roman Empire had moved from Rome to, it was originally called Byzantium, but then it was renamed Constantinople. That was where the capital of the... Are you a history student by any chance?
I studied this history.
Okay, because you seem very familiar with what I said. I was like, okay, this must be a history student, or at least a history buff like myself. So, the Eastern Roman Empire, the capital of Rome moved to Constantinople, of all Rome, and then it split into two parts. And they mostly followed Greek speakers and Latin speakers. The Western Roman Empire collapsed. The Latin-speaking part generally collapsed, leaving the majority part, which was the Eastern Roman Empire, where the majority of Roman citizens, who were majority Greek, by the way, obviously resided. The Western Roman Empire was taken over by Germanic barbarians, unsophisticated individuals, don't know about Roman technology, don't know how to repair it. The West enters its Dark Ages, not because of Christianity, but because simply the Western Roman Empire failed. What happens when barbarians take over an empire and it collapses? It's not going to become the age of science and reason, is it? It's going to be a Dark Ages. And what happened is the Eastern Roman Empire, well, they never called themselves Eastern Roman Empire, they called themselves the Roman Empire. That was what they called themselves. They were the Romans. There was no other Romans. They were the Romans. And here's the thing. When the Western Roman Empire fell, and the Eastern Romans still occupied or controlled Rome. They still controlled Rome. And at the time, there were different cities had different bishops that were obviously given, let's say, their area or their theological jurisdiction, should we just say, or diocese, was in different areas. So you had the Bishop of Rome, the Bishop of Antioch, the Bishop of Alexandria, the Bishop of Constantinople, and they were all part of a council. They were all just all part of a council, all under the Roman Emperor's control, right? And bishops could be appointed or not by the Roman Emperor's diktat. But something happened, and this is actually quite a fascinating story, that the Roman Empire, which had, you know, had wars of the Persian Empire, but also dominated large areas of land, large areas in the Middle East, which were occupied by Christian Arabs. Suddenly, there was a new force that arose in the Middle East, which fought the Romans and went all the way up to Constantinople, besieged Constantinople on two occasions. And this force weakened the Roman Empire to such an extent that the Romans had to retreat out of Italy. They left Italy. This had a very strange and kind of unpredicted effect. The Bishop of Rome was now free from Roman control of the emperor. And being free, the Bishop of Rome and the Roman Church launched many Christian proselytizing missions to these polytheist pagan Germanic barbarians in Western Europe, who didn't, most of them didn't have any written language to speak of. They weren't sophisticated with writing or with any advanced culture, and they certainly couldn't repair the Roman technology. But what the Roman Church, or the Bishop of Rome, initiated was he started to teach these barbarians a way of writing and speaking, taught them Latin, taught them the Latin alphabet, in order for them to be able to speak. And these Germanic barbarians adopted Latin into their language. And when we call the Romance languages, we say French, Spanish, Italian, and Portuguese are the Romance languages. Why we say that is because they all initially were Latin, and they all were, in essence, corruptions. They eventually became corrupted to the extent that they became different languages. But they all started out as Latin. In a way, all these, the Romance languages are different slangs of Latin, to put it another way. That's why they're very common. Britain or England had a bit of an interesting, a different experience, although it did Latinize its language, because there were so many Northmen invasions from Scandinavia and Germania before the Christianization of Germania. Scandinavian languages and Germanic languages were kind of kept being reintroduced into England, to the point that the language wasn't as Latinized as the continent, and so you have many Germanic and Anglo-Saxon or Angles, as they're called, but the Scandinavian words in the English language, which makes English different from the Romance languages, which is more of a Latin slang. Anyway, the Christianization of England, or the reintroduction of Christianity by the Bishop of Rome and a delegation of the Catholics, as they were now called, they always called themselves Catholics, but Catholic means universal, by the way, and technically the Christians of Constantinople were also Catholics. They were the universal church, but the Bishop of Rome fancied that themselves they were the universal church, and they converted over some time the Anglo-Saxons of the English Isles to Christianity, reintroducing it in 600 AD. That's 30 years after the birth of the Prophet Muhammad, just to give you an understanding of time. So it wasn't, 1400 years you could say isn't recent, but it wasn't that long ago. It wasn't 2000 years ago. It was actually coterminous with the beginnings, roughly around the beginnings of Islam. Christianity came actually back to England, or the British Isles. And what was interesting is that over many, many centuries, the Church of Rome, you see, didn't have an army. It relied on asking help from other powers. So it would Christianize these powers. It would offer them help by being administrators and kind of clerks for different kingdoms. And in return, it would tell the people that the kings have to be obeyed by the people. It was their Christian duty for these kings to be obeyed. So it has little kind of arrangement with these different newly converted Germanic kings, that you become Christian and we'll kind of tell the people that to obey you. It's their Christian duty to obey you, so you don't have to worry about rebellions. And also we provide useful services for communications, diplomacy, negotiation between the different kings, because we have branches everywhere, and script and administration, we can take care of all that. Now, okay, they didn't say that as an offer, by the way. I'm just kind of, in a way, kind of giving, as historians do, an analysis of what de facto kind of happened. But interestingly enough, the Catholic Church Latinizing all the, if you were educated in any of these, even in England, you had to learn Latin. It created a common language, and then, in a way, a type of a common culture between all these different Germanic kings in all these different regions. And this was very significant because as the Bishop of Rome, or the Church of Rome, became more and more powerful and had more and more leverage. And again, just to show you how much they hearkened back to the good old days of the Roman Empire, they crowned a Frankish king. Was it Pope Leo III? He crowned the Frankish king Charlemagne as the new Holy Roman Emperor. So you had this basically Germanic former barbarian with blonde hair and the blue eyes being given this kind of pseudo-Roman robe and dressed as a Roman, like a Roman emperor, when he's not really Roman. He's just a Germanic, formerly of a Germanic barbarian. But if we dress him up like a Roman emperor and we call him the Holy Roman Emperor, we can, in a way, kind of resurrect that kind of Roman, the good old Roman times that the Catholic Church used to remember. And this was really the beginning of what you might call Western civilization. But they never called themselves Western civilization, the West. Instead, they called themselves Christendom. And people often think Christendom means dominions of Christianity. But no, it's dominions of the Western Christianity, because the Eastern Orthodox Christians, i.e. those Christians who never separated from the Roman Emperor and Empire in the East, were not included in Christendom. They were not part of Christendom. They're Christians, just they just never left the Roman Empire, and yet they're not considered part of Christendom, which is why the Eastern Orthodox Church and the lands of the Eastern Orthodox Church were never called Christendom. And this kind of then brings us really to the crux of this. It, but the idea of, and the term was actually Christianitas, Christendom in or Latin, in it's Christianitas is the actual term. It only appears in one particular instance. Again, quite interesting. When the Catholic Church, for one, people often debate why it did this. It declared a massive crusade of all believing Christians in Christendom against the infidels or the pagans or what have you. Again, the pagans actually, they portrayed their enemies as idolaters who believed in idols and statues and things, even though that's like the whole complete opposite of the case. But let's stick with this. Because they made this declaration of war, and the Pope then had the ability now to launch wars, to get military mobilization, which in a way is where real power stems from, is the ability to launch military operations. We see in the historical records the first mention of the term Christianitas, Christendom. So that the Crusades actually formalized the idea of a separate individual civilization, distinct from others. That's when it actually you see the word Christianitas mentioned. The earliest mention is actually during the Crusades of this term. And of course, later on, as the countries became, as the Catholic Church encountered Reformation, the creation of a new sect that opposed the Catholic Church, the Protestants, the wars of religion, and of course they had a comment on then the Treaty of Westphalia, which was basically Protestant kings can be Protestant and their countries be Protestant, Catholic kings, their countries can be Catholic. What was it? Chaos regio, eos religio, as the saying goes. Whoever is their kingdom, their religion. It's their religion. But then afterwards, you saw the rise of more secular governments, and then the Christendom no longer was called Christendom, it was just called Christian Europe. But the term West only arose in the 19th century. And in the 19th century, we see that there was a discussion as to whether Russian philosophers discussed this, about the westernization or the Europeanization of Russians, or, you know, the bringing Western European culture into Russia. And there was those who were opposing it, the Slavophiles, those who were more for Slavic culture and so on. And then we see the discussion of Zapad in Russian, the West, those in the West. And then it took on, and of course the Cold War really solidified that Russian term. So the West actually got its name, the West, from Russians. And it was no longer called Christendom, no longer called Christian Europe. It was now called the West. And just so you fully understand proof of the idea that obviously in the time of the Christendom, they didn't consider Eastern Orthodox Christians to be Christian, they didn't consider them Christian at one point. But also part of Christendom is that the Northern Crusades were launched against Slavic Eastern Orthodox Christian countries. They were considered to be infidels, and they launched crusades to the Teutonic Knights, German Knights, knightly order, led crusades against Russians and people in the Ukraine, considering them to be not Christian, considering them their area not to be Christendom, and obviously launched crusades to spread Christianity to these regions and to force convert many of them to Christianity. So in a nutshell, this is actually Western civilization, how it arose as a distinct civilization from other civilizations in the region, and you actually have the Catholic Church to thank for this. But of course, the kind of hidden variableness, the kind of hidden secret that most people don't realize is, I mentioned that there was two cases where they interacted with a foreign power interacted with neighboring powers to cause the West, and it was actually Islamic civilization. It was the Muslims who fought the Eastern Roman Empire, weakening them to the point that they retreat from Italy, that permitted the Bishop of Rome to be free. Also, I actually didn't mention that it was the new ideas that came into Europe from Al-Andalus, the Iberian Peninsula under Islam, also via Sicily, also via the Crusades, that also changed the character of Europe indelibly. But also, the Crusades, which was launched against Muslims, helped solidify the understanding of Europe, or should I say Western Europe, as a distinct civilization from others. And of course, and here's the thing, and this is again why I think it's very important to say that we have to have a discussion on how the West can understand Islam, is because in order to launch these Christian soldiers against this enemy, the enemy had to be portrayed as the worst possible kind of enemy from the darkest history of Europe. And for Christians, or Christendom, it was pagans and idolatry. So they've depicted Muslims as being idolaters who had worshipped statues and idols, and they worshipped Muhammad as an idol and a statue, and they worshipped different gods in a kind of pantheon or of a type of polytheism. And this is completely the opposite case in Islam. Muslims are actually iconoclastic. We don't have statues. We don't believe humans can be gods. We don't believe there are multiple gods. We don't believe any finite thing, moon, sun, mountain, what have you, are gods at all. God is far beyond and transcends the finite universe and finite existence. It was the complete opposite. But in order to get the fellow Western Europeans to hate and to justify war, we were portrayed from the worst and darkest recesses of the Christian, well, the Catholic mindset at the time, because they couldn't fight against a faith that was actually in a way more monotheistic than themselves, because we don't believe in the Trinity. They couldn't do that. It wouldn't motivate Christians to fight, but you could motivate them to fight against pagans and infidels and those who were polytheists. And that is the case, and I think this actually still continues today. But also, and again, here's where language plays an issue. Haven't you seen when, now, generally as Muslims, we believe that Arabic has a special attachment to ourselves because it's the language of the Quran. But we acknowledge that God can be called God in any language. We acknowledge this. It's not that if someone uses the word God or uses the word Theo or Deus, they are worshipping a different God than us. We know it's just a different language, a different word for God. And Arabic Christians call God Allah. Arabic-speaking Jews call God Allah. In the Arabic language, that's it. The language of Jesus, so Aramaic, it's Allah. In Hebrew, it's Eloh. In Aramaic, it's Allaha. In Syriac, it's Allaha. Allah is a Semitic word for God. It comes from a group of Semitic languages. And the spelling is exactly the same. Aleph, Lam, Ha, or La and Ha. The same in all these languages, the spelling is exactly the same. The difference you hear is actually just a pronunciation in these different languages. And yet, whenever you hear, certainly in, let's say, Western discourses, a quote from the Quran, or a quote from the Prophet Muhammad, since I'm talking about God, the word for God is always represented as, or translated as, just Allah. Because in the European mindset, it sounds like a name of a foreign God. Like a foreign idol or a pagan idol, like Baal or Atnatu or some other kind of term. It sounds foreign, sounds alien. And in order to keep it sounding alien, I've realized that some TV channels, some pundits who talk about Islam, not necessarily in favorable terms, retain the word Allah, because when people hear it, I mean, you hear the EDL walking down, doing their marches and saying, who is Allah? They use some expletives, I'm not going to repeat it, but they said, who is this Allah? Well, Allah is the God of Jesus, because it's what he said. You can watch, Passion of the Christ, that film. They tried to do it in Aramaic. They tried to make the whole film in Aramaic. Obviously, the Romans spoke Greek or Latin in it, but they tried to do the whole film in Aramaic, and you could clearly hear the character, which is meant to be depicted as Jesus, using the word Allah every time he refers to God. You can check it for yourself. It's not a foreign word for God, and yet it is retained. People often say, well, is this Islam, it's very foreign, because Muslims who become Muslim, they change their names from English names or French names to Arabic names. That's very alien. We don't understand this. Why do you do this? Well, it's not obligatory to do so, firstly. If your person becomes a Muslim, you don't have to change your name into Arabic. But it's no different, really, to the Christian practice of adopting Christian names. John, Mark, Luke, Solomon, they're not Anglo-Saxon names. Anglo-Saxon names are Ethelred and Canute. That's Anglo-Saxon names. If you want to be all, let's do it indigenous, let's go indigenous. No, these names, Solomon, Luke, John, these are Latinized Hebrew names. And they're called Christian names. So when a person becomes Christian, they adopt what is in essence a Latinized Hebrew name. And it's a practice. So in a way, what I try to show is that Islam is a Semitic religion, as Christianity is a Semitic religion. I actually made this point in the Oxford Union debate. It was on a topic related to religion in England and in the state. And I said, I'm here to talk about so everyone said, okay, because they still are Muslim. And I said, I was here to talk about a foreign religion that came to these shores. It's a Semitic religion. Its followers change their names when they convert to it and adopt Semitic names. And everyone's thinking, oh, okay, Islam, Psalms. Like, yeah, I'm here to talk about Christianity. And everyone's like, what? And then they was, oh, yeah. And they realized, and this is the case, Christianity is a Semitic religion, Judaism is a Semitic religion, and Islam is a Semitic religion, as in a religion that comes from the Semitic cultures and has similar practices. But also, there's some very similar practices. Certainly, for example, to Jews, Muslims don't eat pork, We pray through prostrations and bowings, which was ritualized prayer. Jesus prayed through prostrations and bowings too. This was actually common practice. The idea of just making a supplication, in fact, the idea of praying like this wasn't even early Christian prayer. Early Christian prayer, if you look at the iconography and pictures of depicting early Christian prayer, it was always like this, with the hands out. And when you see Muslims supplicating, we supplicate like this. We don't put the hands together. But early Christians never put the hands together either. This came as a later development in European history. So again, Muslims are not that alien to Christianity as it originally was conceived. But also I found something fascinating. A long story I'm not going to really delve into, but what really kind of gave Christianity a different character to its Semitic past was, some could argue, with St. Paul. It was a Christian saint, viewed to be an apostle, never met Jesus, but he converted to Christianity, and 50% of the New Testament is just his writings and letters added into it. Now, the Church of Jerusalem, which was a church that had the disciples of Jesus heading it, so it was headed by James, purported to be the half-brother of Jesus. Well, could only be the half-brother of Jesus, of course. Heard rumors that Paul was going to Greeks and saying, you don't have to follow the law of Moses anymore. So they summon him back, saying, what are we hearing that you're telling non-Jews, Greeks? The Greeks were the non-Jews, of course. We're hearing you're telling non-Jews or Greeks that you don't have to follow the law of Moses. And of course, Paul denies it, saying, no, I don't say that. I don't say that at all. But do we have to expect non-Jews to follow the law of Moses and the Jewish law and so on? And they have this debate. And then out of this debate, they make a concession. So, okay, tell non-Jews, they embrace, obviously, Christianity, they embrace, obviously, Jesus as the Messiah, and tell them to abstain from food polluted by idols. I'm now quoting Acts 15. From sexual immorality, from the meat of strangled animals, and from blood. For the law of Moses has been preached in every city from the earliest times and is read in the synagogues on every Sabbath. So this is what they say to him. And this is what St. Paul agrees. When I say at the meat of strangled animals, was that Jews were prohibited from eating what we call carrion, meat that was not bled before it was killed. So it had still had the blood in it. And according to the law of Moses, it's considered to be carrion. You know, like if a roadkill, you know, you see roadkill, it's just been knocked over by a car, but all the blood's still in it, and it died in that state, and it's considered to be carrion, not allowed to eat carrion. So they tell St. Paul to tell the Greeks, or the non-Jews who become Christian, okay, they don't have to follow all the law, but they should abstain from meat that has not been bled before it was killed, because that is carrion, and he accepts this. Of course, later on, Roman and then Germanic practices, they didn't really follow that law anymore. But arguably, halal meat and kosher meat, actually, it fits that requirement. And in essence, non-Jews who are Christian, and there are those who do follow this, like the Seventh-day Adventists, they do so. They should be eating halal or kosher meat if they want to follow Christian requirements. And you can read this in Acts 15 in the New Testament, so it's something interesting. The other kind of concern or issue is obviously people in this day and age say, oh, the head covering, it's very non-European. And this is very hard to understand, because you can't argue it's non-European as a practice in of itself, but it's viewed as non-European because it's practiced by people who seem to be immigrants. Yet, many times I've seen, certainly the old generation in my country, in Portugal, my grandmother had a head covering over her head. East Europe, Western Europe, the old generation had head coverings. Well, heck, there's even pictures of the Queen having a having a head covering. And that was viewed to be normal in their times. It was actually viewed to be modest. Even in Victorian era, where obviously you see there's a relaxation of this head covering, Victorian women still always wore hats. At most times, they didn't leave their hair completely uncovered in public, and that was just a practice. It's actually quite common in Europe. But when suddenly, once Europe kind of divests itself from this practice, and yet Muslims come in, suddenly it becomes a strange foreign practice. And I remember, actually, there was a Pakistani sister who told me this interesting story. So they actually went to Spain, and they basically saw Spanish women saw this person wearing, and because Spanish people can also be quite tan, so they didn't know this person was Pakistani. They thought this person was Spanish, so they approached this person and said in Spanish, and that it had to be translated for them because they had a colleague who spoke Spanish. Said, "Oh, it's really good you're reviving the old practices, old Spanish practices." And to which they said, and they didn't understand, and then they realized, "Oh, this person isn't Spanish because he's not understanding what I'm saying." And then the person next to him translated and said, "Actually, this person's saying this," and it was like, "What? I'm actually Pakistani." But that's the case. But when it looks like it comes from a foreigner, suddenly it's a non-European thing. It's an alien. It's used as an alien concept. But also, and quite what I see is, in European history, women have never been treated legally with as much rights as men enjoy in Western history, in European history. This is up until what? Up until just the last century, the idea of marriage involved this concept called couverture, which is that if a woman gets married to a man, the property of that woman then belongs to her husband. Of course, on the negative side, the husband is legally liable for the things that she does, so I don't know how you judge that, but owning her own property, and even getting married, even prior to that, even in English culture, the woman was expected to give a dowry to the man. Or the woman's family has to pay a dowry to the man as well. That was actually English culture. And that's practiced in India as well, amongst Hindus, not amongst Muslims. Because in Islam, the Prophet Muhammad reversed that opposite direction. It's actually the man that has to pay a marriage gift to the woman, not the other way around. And it was quite ahead of its time, and that didn't stop until just recently in European history, and certainly in English history. But when the Western mindset, as I've now defined it, looks towards Islam, it's viewed from the darkest recesses of European history. Oh, Islam must be like us a couple hundred years ago. It must be just like us, this Islamic civilization. They haven't reformed themselves or changed their religion. It must be just like us. Oh, they must ask that women are covered up because women are either, and they make a few assumptions or speculations, that they must believe women are either infantile and need to be treated in this derogatory way, or that women are just sex objects. That's why they have to be covered up, because they're sex objects, which is opposite of the thing. But or that women don't have much rights in Islam. Women can't work or can't speak their minds or can't do any of these things, or are not educated. And they make all these speculations that they project onto Islam. And as many Muslim women can tell you themselves, that's completely opposite the case. I often said, whenever they say that, oh, you know, Muslim women are taught to be meek and timid and so on, I often say, have you met our women? Quite opposite, in fact. Quite the opposite. And what they don't realize is that while women only had the right to vote or have any say in the political processes just 100 years ago in the West, post-Enlightenment, post-scientific revolution, in Islam, 1400 years ago, the Prophet Muhammad ﷺ required that both men and women must give the Pledge of Allegiance to the leader before the leader can have any legitimacy as a leader. And prior to that, in pagan Arabic society, women were not involved in that. They were not expected to be involved. It was the men that decided these matters. You don't need to involve the women from that perspective. But Islam changed that. It changed that. Of course, now, to be fair on the pagan Arabs, they didn't have any issue against women working per se. But if you were the wife of a husband, the husband has absolute authority over the wife. Absolute authority. No rights, no nothing. You're at the whim of the husband in pagan Arabic society. But the Prophet Muhammad changed that. First and foremost, women were given the same rights and even obligation to seek knowledge as men do. Also, unlike what happened in pagan Arabic practices before, the Prophet Muhammad required that women consent to before they get married to whoever is either proposing to them or is being proposed to them. They have to consent. It's they will decide if they want to get married or not to that person. And if they want to get married to someone that their father or whomever does not approve, the father has to give a legitimate reason before that can be held. But even then, if she insists, it can't stop the marriage from happening. If she insists, then she has the right to get married, and the right to get married to whom she wants and who she chooses. And one example of this was a woman was married against her will by her father, so she came to the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam and said, "My father forced me to marry this man. I didn't consent to it." So the Prophet Muhammad said, "Okay, well, you know, I'll annul the marriage." She goes, "Well, no, I actually like the guy, but it's for the principle. I wanted to." She wanted it to be known in that society that you couldn't do this. Just so happened that she actually liked the guy, so she said, "I actually want to stay with him, but I want it to be known. I want it to be known that this cannot happen. This cannot happen." And that was the case in what the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam did. We also see that aside from kind of earning money, there was no even shame on a woman earning more money than a man, even though she earned. So the wife of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, Khadija, was a successful businesswoman. In fact, she was his boss initially, and she actually proposed to him, and he saw no shame in accepting the proposal and being married to, in essence, is a woman that was earning more than him, of course, and was his boss. Saw no shame in this. There's no shame in this. And yet, obviously in Victorian society, with Victorian values, that would be viewed as very odd. And I dare say, post-colonial Muslim societies is also considered to be odd and strange. And why do I say post-colonial? When you look at the Muslim world now, you're actually looking at British imperial values 100 years ago. It's not that Muslims, what they're following now are backward cultures that predate your Western civilization. It's that they were good students of Western civilization 100 years ago. They just didn't get the update, the latest updates via Apple or whatever. So the idea of a woman's place in the home is very much a British imperial concept, or a Victorian concept, which Muslims didn't previously have prior to that point in time. And one example of this is, I kind of typically bring this because it kind of emphasizes the point. So in Egypt, prior to British taking it over from the Ottomans, women studied for and became nurses and doctors, medical practices. And because it was viewed that, you know, if women would prefer to have a female doctor, then obviously there should be female doctors. But there was that advantage, but also that women and men can do whatever they want in terms of profession. That was always been the case. But when the British came and civilized the natives, they expressly said that, well, why do you need to have women doctors? People should just make do with men doctors. Women's place is more for the home. So they stopped women from continuing studying medicine and practicing as doctors, because they didn't view it as a profession appropriate for women. And that's what the Egyptians learned. Because here was a civilization which came 200 years superior. They said they were superior. They said they had superior values. They changed the education system because the education system was funded by the state, and they now control that state. So they changed it. They cut off a lot of the Islamic subjects out of this education system. So they created it in their own image, and then educated Egyptians learnt. If you were an educated Egyptian, you were westernized, and you learnt from the English education system. And the proof of the point is, I just want to give you an example of this, is those who are in the Muslim world who esteem themselves to be the most westernized, they also esteem themselves to be the most enlightened. But if you look at their opinions, they're also very backward. One example: Sisi, President Sisi, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. Again, I often make this point, and I also say it with the understanding that I'll probably never be allowed in Egypt. or I don't really want to go to Egypt, because I know what they do if they hear this, on these enlightened values. He's a secular leader. And yet, during the demonstrations, when he was obviously a military general, he advocated that soldiers molest women or protesters, and those women who who basically advocate that they shouldn't be molested because they're elite, they're virgins, which is obviously trying to invoke some kind of cultural propriety where virgins don't touch us. That the soldiers do virginity tests on the women. You might have heard this on the news. Abdul Fattah, yeah, this was actually quite. You have heard this, okay? Yeah. It was an outrage, and rightfully should be outraged. But he's not an Islamic fundamentalist. He's not some backward medieval relic from the past. If you look at Islamic medieval history, actually, medieval times is probably more enlightened, actually. I'm actually much more enlightened. He esteems himself to be a secular, enlightened, westernized ruler. And the same with Saddam Hussein, same with Bashar al-Assad. They all esteem themselves to be secularized, westernized rulers. And they have opinions that are 100 years old by European standards, at least from Europe. And proof of the point of this is, 100 years ago, in England, it was viewed that clitorectomies were prescribed for women who were just be hysterical, or could get hysterical. And they viewed it as a way of curbing hysteria, quote-unquote, women. Clitorectomies were prescribed by many medical practitioners in England and America. Post-Enlightenment, post-industrial, post-scientific revolution, England and America. So when you have these individuals or these conquering armies coming to the Muslim world saying, we are superior, learn from our values, you're going to get the Muslim world today as a snapshot of what British Empire was 100 years ago. That's what you're seeing when you see the Muslim world today. A snapshot of this. But all the other issues which we see is that on the fringes of Islamic civilization, on the boundaries of the frontier regions, when Islamic civilization declined, the cultural practices that were pushed out to the fringes of Islamic civilization started to come back into those fringe areas. One example is what is called, obviously it is called female genital mutilation, which we see in the Upper Nile area. And people say, oh, this is an Islamic practice. This is what Muslims do. I say, well, it's not. Because there's a reason why you don't see that anywhere in the central areas of the Muslim world. It was pushed out. It was not viewed as civilized practice. It was actually in the frontier zones. And it's a practice that is 3,000 years old. It's a pharaonic practice from ancient Egypt. Practiced long before Islam, long before Muslims. And what they don't tell you is it's practiced by Christians and animists in the same region too. It's a cultural practice. And it came back in as Islamic civilization started to recede and decline. These practices came back in. Same in the frontier regions in India and so on. A lot of practices that were pushed out came back in. For example, just give an example. In Pakistan, many Pakistanis tell me that when a woman gets married, it is expected that the bride's family pay some expenses and even gifts for the husband's family, and or for the husband directly, imitating the pre-Islamic Hindu practice, even though that is not an Islamic practice. That's the opposite. It's the husband that pays. He holds the wedding, he holds the walima, the kind of the marriage ceremony, he pays that, and he also gives a marriage gift to his wife. That's why you'll see that only practiced in that region, but you won't see that practice in Egypt, for example, which is more central. Now, again, Pakistan, the region, wasn't a frontier region, but we saw that as Islamic civilization declined and receded, practices that were pre-Islamic, and certainly, obviously, as a Hindu practice, it's still current, and so it affected and started to come back into Muslim practices in that region. And it's nothing to do with Islam, got nothing to do with Islam, and yet, when it agrees with the darkest recesses of Western history, they project it onto Islam. Oh, this Islam must be doing this because this is what we did back in the past. So it must be Islam being backward. And so even though in Islam it's what we call a bad innovation. What we mean by bid'ah is the Arabic word. It means innovation. But we don't mean it in a good way. Innovation as bringing something new into Islam that wasn't part of Islam. It's actually a bad thing. Technological innovation is good. Innovation in cultural practice is bad. Because you're bringing new practices which will go against Islam. So this is the kind of issue, and yet obviously Muslims are judged by this, and Islam is judged by this. And so just to finish up, And another common misconception, and I suppose this lecture is really becoming a lecture of misconceptions or a litany of misconceptions, but I wanted to do more than just discuss misconceptions, but also discuss where they came from and how they are projected onto Islam, and how they actually come from the darkest recesses of European past. So actually, that's actually two small misconceptions, actually. One misconception is that Islam wants to spread Sharia law across the world onto non-Muslims and make everyone under Sharia law. Firstly, Sharia in Arabic means law. It just means law. So when you say Sharia law, you're really saying law. They want to spread law over us. I mean, technically, the law of England and Wales is the Sharia of England and Wales, and the law of the United States of America is the Sharia of the United States of America. So you can tell this to an EDL person, they'll probably freak them out. England is already under Sharia, the Sharia of England and Wales, and so on, applied by the Queen. So, what, technically, is in her name. So, this projection actually is, in a way, is a projection from the 20th century. And it was an idea that if all political ideas or ideologies, like communism and secular liberalism, the two main ones, they each tout that their worldview is universal. So people say universal human rights. So what they mean is secular liberalism's understanding of human rights. And they say this is universal. And the communists would say the rights of the proletariat are universal, the workers, they're universal for all humans. Everyone must be under the liberation of communism or liberation for the proletariat against the bourgeois, which they view to be backward, following an economic system which they view communism has now superseded. This is the perspective. So the thing is that because secular liberalism believes its views and values are universal, and communism believes its views and values are universal, it believes that every human being must, as a mandatory requirement, be under these values, because it is that's how justice is defined. And therefore, if a human being does not live under secular liberalism or does not live under communism, they are under injustice. So they all must be liberated, whether they like it or not. It's secular liberal and the communist perspective. So that when they hear that Islam has a political project, or at least political laws, and might I add, and this is not a misconception, all cultures and religions up until the time of secularism had laws. Laws and religion was always part of each other. The Torah, what does the Torah mean in Hebrew? It means law in Arabic. It's the same word, Torah. It means law in Arabic. It's obviously a Semitic language. Buddhism had laws for governance, how a state should be governed, what a wise Buddhist leader should rule, and how they should administer justice and money and helping the poor and a whole number of things. They had understandings of laws. Again, Shinto Buddhism in Japan, or Bushido, had the same idea. Laws and beliefs and values all linked together. Hinduism. Hindus don't call themselves Hinduists, or they don't call their religion Hinduism. It's called Hindu Dharma. What does Dharma mean? Law. The law of Hindus. So, even the ancient Greeks, the Romans, yes, the emperors might have made laws, but they all believed that these laws were based on the virtues and values upheld by the Roman religion and by the different gods, the Roman religion. But it was always linked to their religion, linked to their morals and values. Because morals and values come from religion, and morals and values underpin law, therefore there's always a natural link between morals and values and laws. There always has been. Only the very modern times of and colonialism, which spread out to the world, the idea of secularism taught that religion should be only dealing with personal matters of ritual worship, and law should be purely looking at material benefit in this life. That is a brand new idea. We can all thank Thomas Hobbes mostly for that. Thomas Hobbes is actually mostly for that. So Islam just never got the memo from Thomas Hobbes and didn't secularize itself, because why would it? Why should it? And again, you know, Jewish law has laws for a state and government as well. The kingdom of David, the kingdom of Moses. So when Muslims talk about, well, we need in the Muslim world to have Islamic law and create justice as Islamic civilization to finally revive our civilization, suddenly some Western pundits see this and they go, oh, they believe in a political project and they don't accept secular liberalism. That must mean that they want to impose it on us ultimately. Because, that's what we do, in essence, because they view that if something is, if you view this as justice and you view it as universal, then everyone must be under it, whether they like it or not, because that's justice. So they make the projection onto Muslims to think Muslims want to spread Sharia on everyone else. And it isn't the first time they've said this. In the 1890s to about 1940s, in countries, I'm going to just put Germany to the side, I don't even need to talk about Germany, England, France, United States, there was conspiracy theories and anti-Semitism that said that Jews want to subjugate all non-Jews under Jewish domination and Jewish law. They use the same arguments. And prior to that, in Protestant countries, they said Catholics want to subjugate all Protestants to Catholic canon law, law of the Catholic Church. The same arguments repeated again and again and again. This is Groundhog Day for anyone who remembers that film. So it's a repetition again of something that was very old. The same old fears and worries about this minority. Can they trust them? Are they loyalties to the state? Can you guarantee this? And we even see this in John Locke, you know, famous classical liberal philosopher. He wrote this letter called A Letter on Toleration. It's actually ironic if you consider a few passages. He says, but what a church or a religion that doesn't deserve or doesn't have a right to claim toleration is a religion that makes its ruler a foreign power. So either a foreign pope or, and he mentioned Mohammedans, or Muslims, I think. I said Mohammedans or Muslims, I don't know which word he used. He said that they also don't really, cannot really have a basis to claim toleration because they base their religion on the, as he quoted, the Thane oracles, the fatwas of the great mufti of Constantinople, who is under the thumb of the Ottoman Caliph. So we can't really trust Muslims because we don't know if they're fully loyal to our state. That's what John Locke said in his Letter on Toleration. Please read it for yourselves. So basically, he's saying Catholics and Muslims. He also said atheists can't be tolerated because you can't trust. They don't have any morals, and you can't trust what any oaths they give. And so on. I mentioned this in a debate with an atheist who actually liked John Locke, and he was actually quite shocked and saddened that his hero actually would condemn him on this matter. But anyway, so we see this is a recurring theme in European thought, a worry and concern over a minority, and they want to apply their law over us. But it's not the case, and there's a very, very simple thing. In Islam and in the time of the Prophet Muhammad, and ever since, Sharia or Islamic law has only been for Muslims. There's no point. Why would you expect a Christian not to eat pork if they don't believe in Islam? They're not going to earn good deeds if they've rejected this. If they reject a religion you consider to be true, you're not going to get them to earn good deeds if they follow its laws even though they don't believe in it. It's not going to do anything. How would that save them? It won't save anyone to follow laws even though they don't believe in it. That's not sincerity. And we see this very aptly discussed in the Quran. Now, people usually use the term, this verse in the Quran, there's no compulsion in, the word is in Arabic, deen, and they translate it as religion, and that's what I mentioned before about Arabic words. The word deen doesn't just mean religion, it means a way of life and a system of belief. You could translate it as worldview, you could translate it as an ideology, it's a broad term, the word deen. So there's no compulsion in deen, in, let's say, worldview or ideology, what have you. Truth stands clear from error. Now, people usually mention this, but I want to give you another verse. I want to give you another verse which approaches it from a different angle. Most Muslims don't realize this verse has this angle, or they don't realize about this verse. But this verse explains to people who are worried about Muslims spreading Sharia much more than anything else I could ever say. Here's what the Quran says. It addresses Muslims. Had your Lord willed, those on earth would have all believed, all of them together. So will you then compel mankind until they become believers? It is not for anyone to believe except by the permission of God. So here's the verse saying, if God wanted to, everyone would have followed the same religion. They've all been one religion. So if they're not following one religion, this is the will of God. So if that's the case, then who are you, or who is anyone to compel people to follow a religion, if God didn't will everyone to follow one religion? That's what the verse is very clearly saying. And it said that no one will believe, it's not for anyone to believe except by God's permission. As in, God is who controls all things, is ultimately decides who is guided, who is not guided. That's a theological discussion, but it's a discussion that's purely in the hands of God, not in the hands of humans. So, here's the thing. In Islamic civilization, for centuries, Christians had their own law courts. the Armenian Christians, for example, they had their own police for their areas. Non-Muslims were granted semi-autonomous regions, and I'm not saying ghettos, regions. No boundaries, no walls. People can go in and out, but it was jurisdiction purely controlled by them. However they want to manage the jurisdiction of it, semi-autonomous regions. You had in Damascus, you had Armenian quarter, Jewish quarter. You had these ideas of quarters, parts of the city whereby people naturally want to congregate with their own community. It wasn't saying you must only go to this because there were Jews living outside there, Armenians living outside it. But it was a quarter saying that this is their area. You can live outside if you want, but if you want to live inside it, it's your area to run as you see fit. That's it. No one says, you must be following British values. We cannot have ghettoization in our country. You didn't get this. You didn't get this. Multiculturalism has failed. You don't get this argument, which we see in modern Western societies. We saw that Jews were under Jewish law, Zoroastrians under Zoroastrian law. There's even a discussion by Ibn Qayyim al-Jawzi, who wrote his book, I think it was Ahkam Ahl al-Dhimma. So the term dhimma, it means a non-Muslim who is a contract citizen, like, you know, Jacques Rousseau's contract citizen idea. So he discusses the practice of Zoroastrians. There was a sect of Zoroastrians who believed in self-marriage. It was translated self-marriage. It means they can get married to a member of their own family whose brother, sister, mother, father, what have you. It was a practice. Muslims find it abhorrent. It was disgusting. So Ibn Qayyim al-Jawzi discusses it and says, well, look, the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, he ruled over areas where there were Zoroastrians, and he didn't seem to prohibit it. And he discussed the principle in Islam of non-interference, which is, if that's what they believe, and you've offered them to be Muslim, they want to be Muslim, you can't interfere in what they want to do. How they want to do is however they want to live, that's how they want to live. No matter how disgusting you personally find it, it's their culture. Don't interfere with their culture. And the same concept came with also sati, which is it was a Hindu practice of when a woman became widowed, some women were usually the upper class women were expected to throw themselves onto the funeral pyres of their husbands and not remain widows, for example, to kill themselves in essence. It wasn't practiced by every Hindu, and it wasn't by working class generally, but it was a practice. Muslims didn't interfere in that practice. We find it obviously extremely disagreeable, no offence to anyone who believes in sati. Let's just say we find it extremely disagreeable, to put it lightly, but it's not for us to enforce Islamic law on people who don't believe in Islam. That was true multiculturalism. So I say to EDL and xenophobes and even members or people who are influential in government, some neoconservatives, that if Muslims or Islam never applied Sharia on non-Muslims living in Muslim lands, why would we apply Sharia in the West upon non-Muslims? Makes no sense. And just to kind of give you a quote, Richard Bulliet is a famous historian. He wrote this book, a 2004 book, The Case for Islam or Christian Civilization, where he talks about the commonalities of Christianity and Islam and so on. He says this: minutely studying case after case, they have shown that the justice was generally meted out impartially, irrespective of religion, official status, and gender within the Islamic world. Not being subject to Sharia, Jews and Christians were free to go to their own religious authorities for adjudication of disputes, but in many cases they went instead to the Islamic judge. Obviously, they are allowed to go to the Islamic judge if they want to. We're not going to say, no, you can't go in, but it was optional. They could just resolve these disputes amongst themselves. So we see these kinds of discussions. We also see that Prophet Muhammad made prohibitions about what Muslims could against Muslims for how they treat non-Muslims who live amongst them. They say, surely whoever oppresses a muwahid, the Arabic word is muwahid, means like a non-Muslim citizen. So whoever oppresses a muwahid or imposes upon him more than he can afford and humiliates him or takes anything from him without his consent, I will challenge him on the day of judgment. So the Prophet Muhammad forbade even humiliating a non-Muslim living in Islamic lands. The Prophet Muhammad also said, whoever is harmed, another Arabic word for contract, a non-Muslim contract citizen. So whoever has harmed a dhimmi has harmed me. Now as Muslims, we wouldn't want to see a single hair on the head of the Prophet Muhammad harmed. We don't even like people insulting him. And yet, he said that harming a non-Muslim living amongst in Islamic lands or Muslim lands is the same as harming him, the Prophet Muhammad. So under this prohibition, How would Muslims be motivated by their religion to harm non-Muslims, or even humiliate them, or take anything from them without their consent? It's not the case. Why? Why is all this? Because Islam does believe it to be itself to be universal, yes, but why did God make us with free will, and why did God make us on this world? It's to have choice. The whole point of this life is to choose the truth and choose to do good. Without that, there was no point in making us. So yes, Islam believes it to be universal. Yes, Islam believes the Sharia to give justice. But the key but is that it has to be embraced voluntarily by choice, because that's the purpose of human beings, is to make choices. That's our purpose. And that's what the Quran is saying. If God wanted, he would have made everyone one religion. Right? But it's not for us to compel, it's for him to decide, so to speak, who is guided, who is not guided. And it's for us to make that choice as to whether we accept truth or not. So I'll generally kind of leave it there. I've discussed a few misconceptions, but I've also wanted to try to discuss where these misconceptions arise, and a lot of it is self-projections from the dark histories and recesses of the Western mind, and we have to be conscious of this. Just as the first crusaders thought that they were fighting people who were polytheists and idolaters, even though we're the diametrical opposite of that. Likewise today, people depict these wars and fightings, like war on terror and so on, as a fight between those who want to kill non-Muslims just because they're non-Muslim. And I always make the same argument in any debate platform I go on against neoconservatives and xenophobes. See, there are Muslim communities in South Africa, in South America, in Switzerland, in Republic of Ireland. In Suriname, in South Africa, South America, about 14% of the population is Muslim. So it's more than France. France, about 9%. So it's more Muslims proportionally in Suriname amongst a bigger, obviously, non-Muslim population than in France. And yet in all these countries where the domestic policy is non-discriminatory against religion, it doesn't single out Muslims, there's no Islamophobia, their foreign policies are generally neutral. Switzerland, it's Western country as well, Republic of Ireland, Western country, but neutral foreign policies. We don't see terrorism. And I always mention why we don't see terrorism in these countries. And I want to make very clear, terrorism is actually prohibited in Islam. And if you read where many of the Osama bin Laden gets his ideas from, he actually talks about imitating American military history and British military history. That's what he mentioned. In the Q&A, you can ask me that. I'll say more about this, where he gets his ideas from. He actually says, when someone said to him, why did you go against the Prophet Muhammad's prohibitions? An Al Jazeera reporter asked Osama bin Laden in 2001, on October 2001, in an interview on TV, you can find it in the YouTube video online actually, asked, why did you go against the Prophet Muhammad's prohibition about targeting civilians? He says, oh, well, the prohibition, yeah, you're right, that's a prohibition, but it's not set in stone. And then he argues it's logical to fight against the West as the West fights against Muslims and kills Muslim civilians. That's his argument. And then he cites World War II, he cites Hiroshima and Nagasaki, he says Americans didn't care about killing civilians, why should we? That's his argument. Not, well, the Quran told me to kill infidels. No, he didn't say that. Does not say that at all. He acknowledges that he goes against Islamic prohibitions. My argument against Osama bin Laden, my argument to these guys is, I'm sorry, but the prohibition is set in stone. Because as a proud fundamentalist, I follow the fundamentals of Islam. I don't change them when they're not convenient. And yet Osama bin Laden says you can change the fundamentals or not ignore them when it's not convenient, when it's not logical in his mind. I reject his argument. That's not a fundamentalist argument. It's a modern argument. And I've always said this. We can discuss this. But there isn't an existential threat to Western civilization by Islam or by Muslims. Muslims aren't killing Irish people or Swiss people or South American people or South African people. We don't see it there. So I always ask the question, why we don't see terrorism in those countries. And of course, every criminologist and many criminologists and people who study terrorism for a living repeatedly say, like Robert Pape, very renowned American professor of terrorism, counterterrorism, and criminology. He says, It's foreign policy, and every time in human history, the same foreign policy conditions and political conditions have existed, you see the same kinds of acts of terrorism from different people, different religions, different civilizations. It's got nothing to do with religion, it's got everything to do with politics. So we should keep religion out of it. But unfortunately, we always project, we always say, wars must be due to religion, so it must be Muslims are fighting us because Islam tells them to fight us, and they'd be fighting us anyway. Well, no, that's not the case, and Islam doesn't do that. When it's not the Crusades, understand? Projection. So anyway, I hope I've kind of dealt with some misconceptions, but also more importantly, invited you to look at the origins of these misconceptions and how we can stop repeatedly generating these misconceptions, seeing these misconceptions or new ones that arise by making sure that we understand people and civilizations from their own source and from how they understand themselves and not from our own self-projection, because it doesn't benefit anyone. So thank you for listening.
Thank you very much, Brother Abdullah. Anyone have any questions they would like to have?
Questions, comments, and I also invite contention. So feel free to deny what I say, criticize what I say. I actually tend to prefer debates more than lectures. So as a personal preference, I was just one yesterday. So I'm still in debate mode, but I do also want you to criticize or question, because I don't want anyone to be blindly believed or accepted. I want you to ask for evidence and demand it. In fact, so. You have a point.
No, question.
Okay.
So, I was going to ask about the non-interference principle. Like, I wanted to take it to a logical extreme. What if, like, say there's a Muslim of some moderate wealth, sufficient wealth, power, whatever, and he were to come across perhaps a culture that engaged in human sacrifice?
Yeah.
Is he bound to interfere? Or should you remain, you know?
Oh, that's a good point. And again, I mean, it being Kema Jolzi, I mean, encountered this discussions where you talk about Zoroastrians, and of course Muslims scholars discussed sati, the Hindu practice of sati, which in a way is a human sacrificing themselves, and so on. Of course, Muslims didn't encounter the Aztecs, but, as a civilization, they didn't encounter them. But generally speaking, the point of Islam is to offer the message. So as Muslims, when I say non-interference, I mean no physical interference. We say, we're going to stop you, we're going to invade or attack you or what have you until you follow what we think is right for you. No. It's, we're going to tell you what we think is right, here's our opinion, we're going to argue it, we're going to debate it, we're going to offer it to you, we're going to invite it to you, but it's your choice to accept it, end of the day. So if you don't accept it, it's fine, we'll continue reiterating the message and preaching it and so on and so forth until hopefully we can persuade you to adopt it. If not, then we can't get involved and force that culture. Because the whole point is, it has to be choice. They have to volunteer to embrace Islam. For Islam to have any meaning, for Islam to be able to save people, both in this world and the next, it has to be voluntarily embraced. That was the Islamic perspective.
But like, what if the person who was about to be sacrificed was unwilling to offer his life? And you was asking for help, would I be bound to interfere or not?
Well, actually, it's an interesting point. I mean, it is discussed by scholars, and I'm going to be fair and objective. There were classical Islamic scholars who had strong objection to self-marriage and sati and argued we should intervene and so on. So there was a difference of opinion. I'm not going to say it was all homogenous. But in the case of sati, the non-interference principle won out. Actually, in the case of self-marriage, it was non-interference, and then Muslims decided to interfere in some cases, but there wasn't many much cases to be found, and you only know about it if someone tells you about it, so they wouldn't inquire amongst Zoroastrians, are you married to your sister, are you married to your brother? They wouldn't do that. It was all, so it was only if someone would come and say, yeah, well, this is what I did, have you. But so to be fair to obviously the historical precedent, that was the case, but the Prophet Muhammad never interfered in these practices. So it's an interesting debate that classical scholars had, and I can't say that one is the exclusive opinion than another, but all I can say is that was mostly practiced. The opinion that generally won out was always the non-interference principle, because as Muslims, or the Quran says, we're meant to be witnesses to mankind, not compellers of mankind. We see the Quran mentioned many verses, are you to be the wakil, in the Arabic word, a guardian over people who are ignorant. How could you be a guardian of people ignorant? Right? You're not here to be a guardian. A wakil is like someone who is like looks after like a parent, looks after the child. You're not here to do that as Muslims. The Prophet Muhammad wasn't here to do that. You're here to be witnesses, to bear testimony. You understand? So that was the argument that generally won out for the majority of Muslim history, was non-interference. But as for someone who is, well, I mean, technically, if someone is basically being taken to the sacrificial altar, then says, I declare myself to be a Muslim, and under the treaty of protection of Muslims, and I suppose that might be the case when Muslims say, oh, okay, well, he's joined Islam, and so he comes under the treaty agreement between Muslims and the non-aggression pact between Muslims and this particular community, for example. So they can't kill that person because it would be breaking the pact. So that might be the case. Many Islam classical scholars would say intervene, some would say not intervene. It's a case-by-case basis, but generally the majority opinion was not intervene. Because if they were to commit this injustice of killing someone against their will, or we'd even say killing someone even with their will is unjust, some Muslim scholars would debate that would serve as a sign to those who were left behind to say, maybe we should stop doing what we're doing. Maybe what we're doing is wrong, for example. You know, many pagans converted to Islam after they buried their firstborn daughters alive. Because in pagan Arabia, if your firstborn daughter was viewed as a big shame. Like everyone hoped for their firstborn to be a male. Now, not everyone practiced this. You know, maybe the working class probably didn't practice it in the pagan Arab society, but the upper class, they certainly were more concerned about reputation, so they would practice it. They would bury their firstborn alive if they were daughters. And we see this being practiced in India and China as well. There's many, many concerns by different organizations that female infanticide is an issue. So many people did that, and then when they saw that Islam was saying the opposite of this, was saying, you know, the Quran has a very powerful argument against this. When, you know, on the Day of Judgment, the young baby daughter will speak and say, well, for what crime was I buried? For what crime was I killed? For, you know, this very powerful argument in the Quran against this practice. And we see the Prophet Muhammad teaching that if a man, basically, if he dies while having only known daughters in his life, only having daughters, and he's happy to have that he only had daughters, he accepts that, he likes that fact, he's not rueful of that fact, then he will go to heaven. He'll be saved. You know, God will forgive his sins and he will be rewarded for this. Because that was viewed as like the worst thing that could ever happen to anyone in pagan Arab society. Only daughters, oh my God, no sons, oh no. Whereas Islam did the opposite, trying to change that mentality fundamentally. So, but if that wasn't the case, and people didn't do that practice, they might not have seen the error of their ways. So there's a big debate happening. So I would say that some people say intervene in those cases, but generally don't intervene. Some say don't intervene at all whatsoever, and let them see the error of their ways, and let us continue to preach. And sure, we'd like come in there and shout and say, don't do this, and stop what you're doing, and whatever, but whether you should do it by force is a different question. That's the question. So all I can say is that different scholars have different opinions on that, but the majority opinion, or the opinion that tended to win out in India, for example, was non-interference. You, sir?
I have a question about... I'm from Christian education. I'm not Christian at all, but anymore. But I've noticed, well, I know if it's true, but there are maybe some similarities between the Bible and the Quran, in the sense that, in the Bible, I know that there are some passages of the Bible that contradict other passages of the Bible. Like, the Old Testament is very violent, and if you don't believe in God, he will punish you by death. Whereas in the New Testament, in the Bible, he's more loving. I'm generalising a bit, but...
Yeah.
And I've seen a lot of people blaming Islam. Like, I'm French, so in France there's a very heated debate about Islam in France, actually. And there have been lots of anti-Islam people who cited verses of the Quran that promote violence, or maybe it's just wrong translations, but do you think we should alter, as you're a religious guide, obviously, do you think you should alter the sacred text in order to clarify the message today of Islam? Because there are lots of people, I think, the problem is there's lots of misconception about Islam because of what's written in the Quran. It's an old text. And if we could clarify and rewrite it, maybe it would be easier for people to understand that it's not a menace or anything.
Okay. Merci pour votre question. Je vais, avec l'aide de Dieu, donner une réponse. Mais après, en anglais, pas en français. So, I'll speak English, but I just like the ability to practice my French because I don't get much opportunity. Unfortunately, everyone's monolingual here, or not speaking much the European language. But your first language is French, I'm assuming. Okay, you have a great English accent. It's a shame on us. Whenever we speak a foreign language, we sound that we're foreign. Our English accent comes out. Anyway, France is a very interesting case in European kind of politics, because England's quite interesting as well. France is much more secular than England, if people don't understand that. That's because England technically is not actually secular. The head of state is also head of the church. There are, I think, was it 33 bishops in the House of Lords, an unelected body, but then in the House of Lords is unelected generally, so what have you. So that technically means that people who are religious clerics just get to have a say, direct say on laws in England, which is unthinkable in France. Secularism was established in France actually not that long ago, only in the early 20th century as official statute. And the French Revolution was... It wasn't just a French Revolution, then a continuation of secularism from that time until then. There was restorations of monarchies and clerics and a whole bunch of stuff happened in between that point in time. Anyway, long story. But what you see in France is an understanding of secularism which is linked to national identity or nationalism, and the idea that people, if they are free, they look like this. If they don't look like this or act like this, they must not be free, and therefore they need help to look like X, Y, Z. A certain mold is cut for them. Whereas Anglo-Saxon or English secular liberalism offers more what we call negative liberalism, as long as you don't coerce and do this, do what you want, more or less. Of course, there's loads of exceptions and so on. So anyway. And I think in France, for example, there's restrictions on liberty of speech. For example, you can't insult the French flag in a public setting, and at one point you can't insult the president, but that was never enforced and dropped. and so anyway, I mean, there's limitation restrictions, and obviously Americans have different understandings of that. So, but what happened in France is that the outward displays of religion, certainly from non-Catholic religions, is viewed much more as a combination of both a foreign culture imposing onto France as well as a challenge to secularism, because secularism and nationalism are linked together in France and in a way that does not exist in England. So and so in France, the understanding of how people should live is different, and there's a lot of ethnic tensions and problems in France, and it's mostly due to these kind of underlying situations. In England, to an extent, but they follow a different tradition. And America, obviously, is more Anglo-Saxon in its tradition. But anyway, with regards to your Quranic verses, what you mentioned, the Quran or Islam isn't pacifist. It's not a pacifist religion. It's not like the Quakers. But then again, Christianity is not a pacifist religion. Neither is Judaism. And neither is any political ideology. I mean, communists will go to war. Secular liberals will go to war, and in many cases they'll go to war. They'll use offensive warfare to spread their ideology to different countries. So, oh, Saddam Hussein, bad guy. We should get rid of him. Oh, but it's strange how you selectively pick one bad guy who's no longer useful to attack, but then other bad guys you don't. Certainly, bad guys who are sitting on top of resources tend to get more attention. Strangely, coincidentally. And what you see is that when people start opening up the Quranic text, not Muslims, people who are trying to explain terrorism, they want to give another, another narrative other than a more common understanding. Because Muslims, in a way, are viewed that Muslims must act by their religion, whereas we act by secular motives. So if we go to war against Iraq and bomb and kill people, It's regrettable, it's just people doing it, you know, let's blame Bush, blame Blair, it's not us doing it, or we regret it, or World War II bombing Dresden, or bombing German cities generally, just civilian cities, they're not unguided bombs, just dropped on cities with population centres. And Dresden was firebombed, where 30,000 Germans, mostly women and children, because men were mostly out, women and children were burned to death by the British Royal Air Force. The Royal Air Force burned to death 30,000 women and children, and those who were in shelters were cooked to death because it was turned into a firebomb. Oh, you know, that happened back then, it was regrettable, but it was necessary, or whatever. Some people say necessary, some people just say, sorry, it happened back then, or it's too bad, what have you. But whenever a Muslim does something, they say, oh, it's the Quran making do this. And I've had these debates with xenophobes all the time. For example, I debate with, at the time, Tommy Robinson, member of the English Defence League. So he said, oh, Muslims are going around these rape gangs and they are raping these girls. I was like, okay, we know they're raping, we're not saying Muslims, these gangs are going around raping people. Firstly, are Muslims the only rapists in this country? Are the rapes only committed by Muslims? Well, no, majority is committed by those who are not Muslim, proportionally. But these people who are doing the rape, they're drinking alcohol, some even eating pork, taking drugs. Any Muslim will tell you, you can't drink alcohol as a Muslim. You can't eat pork as a Muslim. You can't have sex outside marriage as a Muslim. And yet, English Defence League, Tommy Robinson, was attributing this to Islam, and then he said it was actually part of the Quran. And then he says, oh, the Quran allows you to have sex with slave girls or whatever, which is it's not, that's a whole other discussion, that's not really the case in that sense, but anyway. And so this must mean they rape women because they view them as their slave girls or whatever, which is not even, it's like so outside the bounds of any interpretation ever. But they're desperate to find something in the Quran because they've already decided in their heads that Muslims can only act by Islam. Like they don't, there's no bad Muslims. There's only Muslims who are always good and following Islam. And there's no idea of a Muslim who's not religious or not practicing or what have you. And the only good Muslim that they do recognize is someone who actually repudiates their own religion. Oh, like they had this guy in the EDL called Abdul. And, you know, they said, yeah, he's a good Muslim. And he was saying, I don't really believe in God and Muhammad, but yeah, I'm a Muslim. Yeah, he's a good Muslim. He's a good Muslim. And that's the problem. People debate the issues and say, explain ISIS. They call themselves the Islamic State. So they must be Islamic then. And I always say, okay, so the People's Democratic Republic of North Korea call themselves Democratic and Republic, so they must be a Democratic Republic then. Because they call themselves that, right? And people don't realize that in an area where religion, like Islam, is obviously considered to be very important, everyone has to justify what they do by Islam. Bashar Assad, secular Arab nationalist socialist, but he himself says everything he does is part of Islam. It's not against Islam. President Abdel Fattah Sisi deposed the Muslim Brotherhood, said that we saved Egypt from theocracy, proud secularist, and he basically got, well, he obviously, because he's got the power to, he dictated a fatwa from, in a way, he got a fatwa, a religious ruling from a member of the Al-Azhar institution to say that it's okay for his soldiers to shoot protesters. A so-called Islamic fatwa. It was him telling them what to say, and they said it. Oh yeah, Islam says it. Saddam Hussein, I consider him to be the father of ISIS because ISIS, it was exposed by the Spiegel that they're formed of former Ba'athists. And anyone who knows what a Ba'athist is, it's an Arab secular socialist. Right, that's what Ba'athists were. And then when they lost power, oh, they suddenly, what, found religion and became ISIS? Oh, how coincidental. Right, what did Saddam Hussein do in 1993 to shore up the power of his government, to get more legitimacy from the people? He put Allahu Akbar on the flag, Iraqi flag. He said that he was a descendant of the Prophet Muhammad, sallallahu alaihi wasallam. And he created a Islamic militia called the Fedayeen. And he would use Quranic verses, and I saw his videos, I saw videos of his police forces and his soldiers beating the people up, and they would quote verses of the Quran as they're doing it, even though these verses of the Quran have like no relation to what they were doing, but they couched it in these Islamic terms. So I'm not surprised that his children, ISIS, did actually literally the exact same thing as Saddam Hussein. But no one would say Saddam Hussein was an Islamic leader, because he was secular. Everyone knows he was secular. And yes, what did ISIS do? they put Allah on the flag, the leader, they say he's the son of the Prophet Muhammad, and they create militia and so on and so forth. I also made this point in a debate with individuals who were supporting Bashar Assad, and they were criticizing ISIS. And I said, yeah, I criticize ISIS too. But in this debate now, I started out the debate by saying, I want to play a game with the audience. Who can name me this group? There's a group of people who are, they say they're fighting for Islamic cause, they kill civilians, they kill people of different schools of thought they don't agree with, or they attack mosques and they destroy these places, and they get foreign fighters to come for them under the name of jihad to join their forces, to fight for their leader. They get children soldiers to join them, or they force children to join their ranks. Who are they? And everyone's like, oh, it's ISIS, right? ISIS, right? Oh no, it's Bashar Assad. The leader of Bashar Assad. Foreign fighters from Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Iraq joining his army as militia groups under Islamic declarations of jihad against what have you. Oh yeah, I also included my question. They say Allahu Akbar before they fire their guns. There's videos of Syrian army. They got a cannon. They're pulling the cord and the cannon shoots and they go Allahu Akbar as it happens. And then everyone thought I was saying it was ISIS. It actually was Bashar Assad, who is also a Ba'athist, just like the leaders of ISIS. So unfortunately, the West, they don't see that there are people in the Muslim world that have the same motivations or can be as different from their religion as Westerners can. And yet everything that Muslims do, oh, that's their religion. No idea that you get wacky crackpot Muslims who go outside the fold of Islam a thousandfold. And in Congo, for example, there was a group called the Anti-Balaka Movement, if I'm pronouncing it correctly. And it was an ethnic conflict or a conflict between different groups, but they happened to be Christian. They didn't like this, they had issues with Muslim minority because there was a militia group that had majority Muslims in it that was in control. They didn't like them, they fought against them. They were removed from power, and then they started to fight against all Muslims in the Congo region. And they asked that all Muslims must convert to Christianity or die. They made a declaration. They beheaded people. You had pictures of them with knives, cutting people up. They ate people, literally eating it. Again, eating disgusting things you can see. Actually, cannibalism. Pictures, undisputed pictures. Not you know, fringe. Undisputed on mainstream newspaper. Well, actually, I want to say mainstream. Mentioned briefly on mainstream newspapers. And yet no one says, oh, Christianity, oh, look what it's doing. Look what it's doing in Congo. No one says that. Because we all know that's not Christianity. But had they been Muslim and did exactly the same things, oh, it's the Quran that tells them to do that, they would say. So that what I'll tell you is, the Quran has verses that urge fighting, yes, and the Quran has verses that urge peace. But more importantly, and here's what the Quran says on this matter, is that it says, fight those who fight you. That's what the Quran says. Fight those who fight you. And God does not forbid you against those who do not fight you for religion, nor persecute you or throw you out of your homes from being kind and just to them. And then the verse continues, God only forbids you against those for making allies against those who fight you for your religion and throw you out of your lands because you say that your God is God. You only worship one God. The Quran says this. Only forbids you from making friends or allies with those people who fight you because of your religion. But if they don't fight you because of your religion, then you don't fight them. That's what the Quran says. No one quotes that verse, strangely, in the Quran. And whenever we see ISIS and these terrorists say what they say, you know what, I've made some big claims. I've made some claims about what Osama bin Laden said and what have you. I like to bring my laptop because I always want to bring the exact citations and the exact references. So if you want to get your pens and papers out or listen to the video later on, I'll give you the citation. So this was an interview, an Al Jazeera interview, October the 21st, 2001. You can see it quoted in a book written by Professor Bruce Lawrence called Messages to the World, The Statements of Osama bin Laden. You can see it, he reiterated it there. So here's what he says, Osama bin Laden says, our religion forbids us from killing innocent people, such as women and children. He talked about the Muslim scholars. They say that the killing of innocents is wrong and invalid, and for proof they say that the Prophet forbade the killing of children and women, and that is true. It is valid and has been laid down by the Prophet in an authentic tradition. But this forbidding of killing children and innocents is not set in stone. If the disbelievers were to kill our children and women, then we should not feel ashamed to do the same to them, mainly to deter them from killing our children and women again. That's his argument. And then he continues in a... there's another citation, an interview by an ABC reporter, 1998. I'll read it. So people asked him about his justification of fighting Americans and attacking civilians. Here's what he says. Here's what he says as his argument. Not from the Prophet Muhammad's history. He says this. America has not been known to differentiate between the military and the civilians, or between men and women, or adults and children. They threw atomic bombs and used the weapons of mass destruction against Nagasaki and Hiroshima, and these were the Americans doing this. Can the bombs differentiate between military and women, and infants and children? America has no religion that can deter her from exterminating whole peoples. Your position against Muslims in Palestine is despicable and disgraceful. America has no shame. We believe that the worst thieves in the world today and the worst terrorists are the Americans. Nothing could stop you except perhaps retaliation in kind. That's his argument. And of course, when Bush said they're fighting us because of our freedom, Osama responded to this. He said, you say we fight you because of your freedom, then why don't you explain why we don't attack Sweden? That's his argument. And yet, the politicians are trying to portray that these people are attacking the West because we are non-Muslims, or this is a non-Muslim country, and they just want to kill infidels. Or they don't like our freedom. But that's not their argument. Now, he himself admits he goes against Islam, and his logic is anti-Islamic. But he's not taking his example from the Prophet Muhammad. He's not saying, well, the Prophet Muhammad did this, so I can do this. His argument is, America's doing this, so we should retaliate. That's his argument. So people tell me, Abdullah, what are you doing to counter the Islamic arguments or the interpretations of ISIS or Al-Qaeda? I say, what interpretations? Because the only thing they bring is Western military history. They don't bring the Prophet Muhammad. They don't bring the Prophet Muhammad to Islam's history. So I know it's a bit of a big answer, but because your question touched upon a number of things, I thought you needed to hear this. So I'm giving you some citations. There's you can see more on my website, but I think it's very important that you know this, and as I mentioned these citations because I don't want you just to say, oh, Abdullah claimed it, or Abdullah's just whitewashing Islam or trying to hide. No, here's the references, here's the evidence, you read it for yourself. Any other questions, comments, or contentions? I think I've tied everyone out. Nothing else? Any other minor points?
I think that's good.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Abdullah.
No problem, thank you.
It's very important, obviously, to have like people like Abdullah coming. And Abdullah has come all the way from London. He actually had a debate, which he got back from 5 a.m. this morning. So he came over in the morning. So again, thank you very much. And,
sorry.